Can we prove things exist that are unknowable? That's the topic today on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. We are talking to Professor Gregory Chaitin, the co-founder of the field of algorithmic information theory that explores properties of computer programs via their length and their degree of compression. Professor Chaitin, welcome.
Glad to be with you today.
Okay. You wrote a book for Springer in 1999. It was called The Unknowable. And also, there was a tribute book to you, Unraveling Complexity, the Life and Work of Gregory Chaitin. And you were solicited to be an author of one of the chapters. I think it was the second chapter, and it was entitled Unknowability in Mathematics, Biology, and Physics. This is a big deal. What is unknowability from your perspective?
Well, okay. So I have a number I was proud of discovering called the halting probability omega. And that is something where you can prove that you can define it mathematically very simply. Well, maybe not that simply, but the fact that you can't prove in general that you can't prove that programs are elegant is a simpler incompleteness result. The fact that the base two bits of the numerical value of the halting probability omega is maximally unstructured and maximally unknowable, it's irreducible mathematical information. That's actually, I guess you have to go through a course on algorithmic information theory to do that. The ideas are simple, but now the question is, does that number exist? You know, it exists in the mind of God. It exists to an infinite mind. It is knowable. You could calculate each bit, but we're not infinite minds, right? And there's also the question of, you can argue that it doesn't even exist, that it's a fantasy object, that it's mathematically, it doesn't use very sophisticated math. There's much wilder mathematics. But the numerical value of this number is maximally unstructured and maximally unknowable. So if you think about the kind of things you do normally in mathematics, this is a forever unknowable thing, the value of each individual bit in the numerical value of this number. But you can counterattack saying, this is a fantasy. It's the real number to an engineer is a fantasy. The real number has infinite precision, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't work with infinite precision. We're happy to get a few decimal digits. Different problems need more precision. But infinite precision is nowhere to be found except in the imagination of mathematicians who talk about a real number, which is determining the position of a point with infinite precision. But the mathematics is simpler. It makes for beautiful mathematics, and a lot of physics is based on partial differential equations and mathematics that depends on the fantasy of infinite precision real numbers. So in a sense, it's justified by its practical applications. But nowadays, not so much, because people don't solve equations that much anymore to do engineering. They use computer simulations, right?
Or they go to Mathematica, yeah.
Right, which is using finite precision mathematics, not infinite precision real numbers like you do when you have equations and you want to prove properties of the solutions of the equations. This is how things used to work, right? Or find an analytic solution to an equation. That only works for very simple systems that you can solve in a closed form mathematically. And that's disappearing into the past, right? People are more concerned now with calculating than they are with proving theorems. In that sense, I'm a dinosaur, you know.
Well, in fact, we have a name for them in engineering. We call them keyboard engineers.
Right.
If they're presented with a problem, they don't go to the theory, which gives you depth and insight into what's happening. They go to a keyboard and try to work things out just to get a surface sort of answer.
Yeah, and that's good enough for most practical purposes, right?
Yes.
Instead of messing around with very complicated equations and trying to find an analytic, a closed form solution, you simulate the system and see how it behaves. Then you change the design a little bit to see if it behaves better, more like what you want. So that's a new paradigm that the computer enables us to do. So you can argue that the omega number doesn't exist, and also it deals with the question of an infinite amount of time for the calculation. Will the program halt if given an arbitrary large amount of time? Now, computers will not last for an arbitrary amount of time, right? they'll break.
Yes.
Or the Earth will freeze, or the sun will go nova. It's like talking about unicorns or flying horses.
Let me tell you a pushback that I got from the idea of unknowable. I mentioned, I'm a big fan of your proof that elegant numbers are unknowable. I think it's very, very insightful. It's beautiful.
It's a very simple proof also.
It's a simple proof, and I think according to Paul Ergos, it would probably go into God's book as the simplest explanation of something.
Thank you. That's the nicest thing you ever said to me. Most people prefer the omega number, fascinates people. A religious person once in Vienna told me that he viewed it as a step closer to God because it shows something that the mind of God, there is a numerical value, but we can't get it, right?
Yes. Well, I think also that your omega, your work on the omega number, as is referred to as Chaitin's number, it also belongs in God's book, so it's also beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Jack Schwartz, though, he never liked my work on the omega number. He liked the proof that you can't prove that a program is elegant.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I greatly admired him.
I still dwell, and we're going to, in a subsequent podcast, get deeper into Chaitin's constant, or what you call omega's number. Here's the pushback that I got from this, Greg, is that I mentioned this proof of your proof of elegance, mm-hmm. that elegance was unknowable to somebody. And they say, well, that doesn't mean it's unknowable. It means only that it's non-computable. And I guess my response was, yeah, non-computable, does that equate to unknowable? I think that that's the assumption here. And what's your take on that?
Well, there's no program to calculate it. There's no way to prove it. So I don't know in what sense. Now, for all practical purposes, you can determine, for example, whether a program is elegant. You run a lot of, it's like the halting problem. If you limit the amount of time to some reasonable amount, like one day of calculation, which is certainly a lot, you just run it for a day and you see whether it halts or not. And if it hasn't halted, you just assume it's never going to halt. For all practical purposes, that may be a good answer. But if you don't put a time limit, now that's a mathematical fantasy then, you see. But mathematics deals with fantasies because they have clean, beautiful properties. You can prove theorems. So that mathematical fantasy has often served practical purposes in, for example, theoretical physics. So it's a complicated issue. It's a complicated issue. Now, for example, if you toss a coin a lot of times, almost certainly the result is algorithmically unstructured or random. It cannot be compressed into a smaller program. And you can even get estimates on how very probable this is. And it can be enormously high probability. So will you allow that as an argument to say that I'll toss a coin and get a lot of zeros and ones? You do it a reasonable number of times, not just three times. And then you most probably it will be very close to maximum program size complexity, which would be n bits. There won't be any programs substantially shorter than n, and you can quantify that, you know, what the cutoff is. So something is almost certainly true, but you could never prove it from a mathematical axioms, which are less complicated than the number of bits of the sequence you're trying to show is random, or is unstructured. So, and there's also the question of which axioms are you using? My belief is that pure mathematics should evolve, should be creative. You can add new principles. And in fact, during my lifetime, I've seen a number of new principles added to pure mathematics. So these questions are all complicated to discuss. Like most philosophical questions, you know, on the one hand, this, and on the other hand, that. And they're all good arguments, and you pays your money and you takes your choice, right?
Yes, yes. So elegant programs, just to remind the listeners, an elegant program is the smallest program to achieve some objective. There exists a smallest program, so that is the elegant program. You can also think of it as I like to think of it in terms of images. If you have a big image, what is the most that you can compress that image? And that would be the elegant program for the image. Greg, I know that you've spent a lot of time with your proof of that elegant programs are unknowable. Do you have a simple explanation that you can walk through that people of modest education could understand?
Well, I try.
Okay, let's give it a try.
In my experiment in autobiography that's included in the book Unraveling Complexity. By the way, there's another Festschrift that they did for me when I was 60. This book was intended to be for my 70th birthday, but it dragged on a number of years. So it got published when I'm 73, I guess, or 72 when it was published. So there are two Festschrifts, actually. So in the attempt at an autobiographical essay, I have a 14-page autobiographical essay in Unraveling Complexity. I go through what I see as the essential ideas in the proof. I've often tried to prove it when I'm invited to give a talk at a university. And I have a funny test for whether I explained it well. When I explain it well, people laugh when they realize the paradox of how the proof works. People laugh. And when people just stare at me with glazed eyes, obviously, or they don't laugh, it means I didn't explain it well. So let me see. I can try to give an even simpler explanation than is in the experiment in autobiography.
Well, Greg, now I'm paranoid. I don't know. I hope I laugh after your explanation.
Okay, so here's the idea. Let's say you have a provable means provable from a fixed set of axioms and rules of inference, right? This is a formalization of axioms for mathematics. And Hilbert thought there would be one system that all mathematicians could agree on. And so once you've taken all the subjective element out, it's like a computer program. You just run through all possible proofs, you check which ones are correct, you filter out the correct proofs, and that way you get all the theorems of mathematics, it would be if Hilbert had come up with a formal axiomatic theory for all of math. Okay, so now whatever the system you're looking at with whatever the axioms and rules of logic, it can be implemented as a computer program. It's sort of the proof-checking algorithm, and which always gives an answer, the proof is correct, the proof is incorrect, to an infinite runtime algorithm that just generates all the proofs in order of the size, all the theorems in order of the size of the proofs, is but a small step. So you just look at the size in bits of either the proof-checking algorithm or the algorithm, actually it's more correct to say the algorithm that runs through, checks all possible proofs and gives you all the theorems. Okay, and you look at the size in bits of this. This is the algorithmic information content or the complexity of that formal axiomatic system you're studying to see what it can achieve.
If I remember right, you step through numbers one at a time and check if it's meaningful or not, right?
You check through all possible proofs one at a time.
And those correspond to numbers, is that
correct? Well, they correspond to strings of characters in the alphabet. You can also just go through the tree of all possible proofs. That's another way to get all possible theorems in one by one, endless computation. So this thing will require a certain number of bits. That's sort of the bits of axioms you're using in this version of mathematics, which people thought they would have a definitive version of. So let's say the program that does this, either the proof checker or the one that runs through the tree of all possible proofs, or the one that checks all possible theorems, all possible proofs in size order and gives you all theorems. Let's say this is n bits, whatever that is. So now you start running through all possible theorems until you find a proof that a program that is substantially more than n bits long is elegant, which means it's the smallest program that calculates the output it does. Okay, so you want to see if your formalization of mathematics and all its principles enables you to prove that a program that is larger than the program which is the software embodiment of that of those mathematical principles of that formal axiomatic system, its axioms and its logic, rules of inference. You keep running through all the theorems, all possible proofs and all the theorems, until you find a proof that a program that is substantially bigger in bits than the number of bits for the software implementation of this process to run through all possible proofs and get all the theorems. So, and then what you do, you take that program, which is elegant, and you run it, and then you see what its output is, and this is your output. So what we have is a process, a program that is basically the number of bits in size of the number of bits of axioms in your mathematical theory. And we're using this theory to attempt to prove that programs are elegant. And we keep looking through all the theorems until we find a proof that a string of zeros and ones, a finite string of zeros and ones that is substantially larger than the software implementation of your mathematical system is elegant. So then you run this program and its output is your output. Okay, this is a process you do that will come to an end and give you an output. Now look at this program that I've described in words. It has a number of bits, which is basically the number of bits for the software implementation of your axiomatic theory. And it's giving you an output, which is the output of the first provably elegant program that is substantially larger than the number of bits in your mathematical theory. Now, this is a contradiction, because this output that you've gotten, supposedly the elegant program was you've proven the program was elegant from these axioms. And that means that this is the smallest, most concise program that can calculate the output that it does. But you've calculated with a substantially smaller number of bits because you found it by running through all possible theorems, all possible proofs in your mathematical theory. And by the construction of this paradox, you keep running this process until you prove that a program is elegant that has substantially more bits than the program which is the software implementation of your mathematical theory. So now this has given you a smaller program than the supposedly elegant program to calculate this object. And that's impossible by the definition of elegance. So either you're proving false theorems or you can never find this program. If you only prove true theorems, the elegant program for the thing you calculated is substantially larger than the number of bits in the program that found this the proof of this, that this program is elegant. So you've actually compressed the output from this supposedly elegant program even more into a shorter program. And that's impossible by the definition of elegance. So if you assume that only elegant programs can be proved to be elegant, in other words, that the theorems you're proving are true, you never find a proof that a program is elegant if it has substantially more bits than the software implementation of your mathematical theory. The only way you avoid the contradiction is if this process never finds a proof that this program that is substantially larger than your software implementation of your mathematical theory is elegant. Okay, so in other words, any mathematical theory can only prove that finitely many programs are elegant. They have to be smaller in size than the software implementation of the mathematical theory. But there are an infinite number of elegant programs, you know, because
they get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, because for any programming task, there is a most concise program for it. The problem is you're not going to be able to prove that you've got it if the number of bits in your program is larger than the number of bits in your mathematical theory. I don't know if this was understandable or not. It depends on the notion of a completely formalized objective, not subjective, notion of mathematics. What I'm criticizing is not the ability of mathematics to do things. Gödel thinks that mathematicians are not limited by his theorem, but they can directly intuit facts from the Platonic world of ideas. So this incomplete result that I've given you only applies to totally formalized, computerized mathematical theories. But Gödel doesn't think it applies to human mathematicians, in fact. But to be able to say what you can prove and show that there are limitations, you have to give a very precise definition of the methods you're allowing in the proofs. And once you do that, you're in trouble, because if it's n bits of methods that you're allowing for mathematical proofs, then elegant programs that are more than n bits long, you'll not be able to prove that they're elegant. Does that sound more understandable?
Yeah, no, it's a proof by contradiction. You assume that the elegant program detector was algorithmic, and then you showed that there was a contradiction in your assumption.
Yeah, well,
therefore it can't exist.
Yeah, right. Nobody laughed, so I guess I fumbled the ball.
Oh, nobody laughed. Okay, what was the joke? I missed it?
Well, it's the contradiction.
Oh, okay, the contradiction. Okay, maybe it was because of my familiarity with the proof.
I explained it badly.
No, I don't think so at all. I think that in my class, when I explain proof by contradiction, let me tell you my favorite example. It's the proof that all positive integers are interesting.
Ah, yeah, that's related to all of this. stuff
that we've been talking about. It is. And so you've heard about this. Yeah, sure. So the idea is that if they are interesting, you assume the opposite. If they're not interesting, then there is a smallest non-interesting number. But hey, that's interesting. So
absolutely.
That's the proof by contradiction.
That's sort of similar, because interesting number, if you want to define it carefully mathematically, is one for which there's a program to calculate it that's smaller than it is. If you want to have a concrete notion of interesting. So an uninteresting number would be one that is whose numerical value is irreducible. And that's exactly the proof. That's probably better than what I was saying. Yeah, that's you're right. That's the way to explain this. Yeah. You've taught it to real human beings. That's a very good explanation, because then the next step from that to get to my incompleteness theorem is to say, well, what does interesting mean? And one good definition of interesting is an interesting number is one that stands out because there is a more concise definition of it, or more precisely, a program that is substantially smaller than its numerical value that calculates it. That's some way it stands out from the run-of-the-mill numbers. And the run-of-the-mill numbers are ones whose numerical value is a incompressible or irreducible string of bits. So you can sort of go step by step from that paradox about the smallest uninteresting number, which is ipso facto interesting, to a proof of an incompleteness result, very similar to mine.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, a new topic. I wanted to talk to you about, we're talking just in general about the unknowable. Roger Penrose, he recently won a Nobel Prize for his work with Stephen Hawking in black hole theory. Wrote a book called The Emperor's New Mind, and he had a follow-up, which I think is The Shadows of the Mind or something like that. But in the book, he says that creativity is non-computable. He uses your work, along with Turing's work and Gödel's work, to make an argument that creativity is non-computable, and therefore is something which, if we're to pursue it by artificial intelligence, something that will never be done. Now, he refers to quantum as possibly the only non-algorithmic thing which occurs in nature. So he says all of this stuff must be due to, he posits, of quantum tubules in our brain and quantum collapse or something like that. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether creativity is computable or not computable, or do we know yet?
Yeah, I do have thoughts on this, and one or two remarks. One remark is that I did meet Penrose at Cambridge at a meeting. We were both speakers, and I went to him and I said, the reason you think that a machine is the reason you think that a machine can't equal human intelligence because you believe that we have a divine spark and computers don't have a divine spark. And he answered, a trifle annoyed, I think, not at all.
Yes.
So.
Well, he did revert to a materialistic solution,
yeah,
which is quantum mechanical. So, yes.
Yeah, I've been worried a lot about creativity lately when I started working on biological creativity and I connected it with mathematical creativity. There is this paradox, just like the first uninteresting number is ipso facto interesting, there's a problem with creativity, with having a algorithm for creativity, a computer program for creativity. The problem is that if you know how to do something, ipso facto, it's not creative anymore.
Yes. And that's the problem with identifying creativity. One can have a creative spark and you explain it to somebody. They sit there and rub their chin and say, well, that's obvious.
Yeah, well, creativity is what we don't know how to do. And so it looks like it's a hard thing to program, because if you try to program creativity, well, that just becomes something mechanical. And the frontier between what's creative and what isn't just moves a little forward. It's a problem. There could be a I think that my attempts of a little toy model of biological evolution, this is a controversial point, is a first step in the direction of a mathematical theory of creativity. I believe that Gödel's incompleteness theorem and Turing's work on the uncomputability of the halting problem are baby steps, well, they're big, big baby steps, in the direction of a theory of creativity. That's normally not how you view them, but I feel they feed into my little attempts at looking at biological creativity with a painfully simplified toy model. So there is a paradoxical aspect to creativity. Now, you could have a mathematical theory of creativity that enables you to prove theorems about creativity, but is not implemented in software that doesn't give you an algorithm for being creative, because if it's an algorithm, it's not creative, right? So, but you might be able to prove theorems about creativity. You see, like I can prove theorems that most numbers are random, but I can't, are unstructured. I can't produce individual examples that I'm certain are. So it might be that you could prove theorems about creativity, but the theory wouldn't give you a formula, a recipe for being creative, because once it does that, then it's not creative. You see, there's this paradox.
Yeah, and also those theorems that you're talking about are kind of meta. You're using creativity to write theorems about creativity.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Yes.
And one of the important things is to define creativity. I know somebody that knows you. I'm not sure if you know him, Selmer Bringsjord, who said he met you, I believe, at a recent meeting. But he has something called the Lovelace test, which is a lot better than the Turing test. He says that a computer program will be creative if and only if that computer program does something which is outside of the intent or explanation of the programmer. And I think that that's a very deep, the Lovelace test is one that I believe that hasn't been passed yet. So it's going to be interesting to see if in the future of AI that we do have anything creative.
Yeah, well, I think I met this gentleman in Thessaloniki.
Yes, I believe that was where he mentioned that he met you, yes.
Yeah. Well, Turing says he'll believe that a computer is intelligent if the computer will punish him for saying that the computers aren't intelligent.
Okay. Now, see, I think that's funny. Okay. What did he mean by punish you? Come up and whack you across the head? What did he mean by that?
I guess Turing is referring to a notion of truth based on political considerations. You know, people will say something's true if the society will fire you from your job if you disagree, you know.
The other thing you mentioned in your book is Tanani's fee function model of consciousness, which I must admit I don't totally understand.
Me neither.
But don't you? Okay.
It's complicated.
Well, that's good.
It's
complicated. It is complicated. And in Christoph Cox, one of his presentations about the theory, he got the people in Silicon Valley mad because this was a report that I got from somebody that attended Cox's lecture, that they were mad that this was possibly non-computable, at least with the resources that we have now or the immediate future. So it seems to me that Stephen Hawking, it says, nothing is ever proven in physics. You just accumulate evidence. And so I think evidence is accumulating insofar as the non-computability of some human attributes. At least that's my personal take.
I had something I wanted to say.
Okay, about Tanani?
I actually prefer, it's a complicated definition, and as it's, you would need to do immense amount of computing. You have to look at all possible partitions of a physical system and calculate certain mutual informations. It's a horrendous exponential growth computation. I actually prefer, I know it's fashionable now, I actually prefer the original approach in Chalmers' book, I believe 1996, was it, The Conscious Mind? He has an idea similar to Leibniz's monads of panpsychism.
Oh, yes.
Everything has some degree of consciousness. It may be greater, it may be smaller. The maximum monad corresponds to God, whose consciousness is the largest possible, conscious of everything, right? A rock doesn't have that much consciousness. But he believes a physical system has n bits of consciousness if it has n bits of memory and processes these n bits. So that would mean that a on-off light switch would have one bit of consciousness, and a human being would have a lot of bits of consciousness. You know, it's hard to have a cutoff, for example. If humans are conscious and people who love dogs are certain that dogs are conscious, So is there a sudden place where consciousness blanks off as you go to more primitive life forms, bacteria, viruses, light switches? So it looks a little implausible from a philosophical point of view. It seems more like it'll just be gradually less and less consciousness, right? And you can go in the other direction. You can have a corporation. Does that have a consciousness? Does the internet have consciousness? Does the whole universe have consciousness, which presumably would be God? I actually, my latest and hopefully not last paper is on consciousness, and it's just being published in a book in honor of one of my distinguished colleagues here in Brazil, but it's on my website. It's consciousness and information, and then comma, classical, quantum, or algorithmic, question mark. Because Chalmers didn't know that, but maybe at the time there weren't three, at least more than three, definitions of information. There's Shannon information, entropy. There's quantum information theory, which maybe didn't exist in 1996 or was very incipient, and now it's a very big, fashionable topic. And there's algorithmic information. And I'm sort of looking at Chalmers, is it 25 years later? So it's a philosophical essay.
It's interesting. I've always looked at panpsychism as kind of a weird philosophy. I'm wondering if there's any way that it can be tested. I doubt it. It's going to be interesting to see if it can.
Yeah.
But the posit is that consciousness is part of the universe, just like mass and energy and all of the other stuff.
Well, you know, there are idealistic philosophies which say that the universe is spirit, really, and matter is sort of an illusion. So that's sort of related to an idea that I've been backing, which is the universe is made from information, that's the basic ontological basis. The normal view, if you dabble in metaphysics, is the universe is made from mathematics. That's a Pythagorean idea, that God is a mathematician. And I prefer to say God is all is algorithm. God is a computer programmer or a programmer. There's a book by a theologian, an Italian theologian, a priest, on this subject called Big Bang, La Nascita della Filosofia Digitale. Unfortunately, it's a wonderful book. Unfortunately, it's only in Italian. So it's saying that the universe is built out of information is like saying that the universe is really built out of spirit, or the universe is in the mind of God. It's not a material object. And the new version that physicists love is to say the universe is built out of quantum information. They want to try to get everything out of quantum information, including space-time, due to entanglement between qubits, for example. That's a fashionable topic. But in a way, we're looking at an old idea, which is the universe is in the mind of God, or the universe is spirit, and matter is idealism as opposed to materialism, which is why this theologian was interested and put together a wonderful book surveying all of this work that unfortunately I don't think anybody's translated. Maybe Google Translate could do a great job on it.
Maybe. Yeah, I think that still has a long way to go. Well, Greg, we're running really over time, so we're going to have to end this conversation. So thank you so very much. This was just a fascinating chat. We've been talking with Professor Gregory Chaitin about knowability and unknowability, and what that means and the implications for us. Fascinating stuff. So until next time on Mind Matters News, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.